Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of The Allure of the Pour. Today, I am so excited to sit down with Mark Davidson, Education Manager for North America for the Wines of Australia. If I'm giving full disclosure here, this episode should have been released over a month ago, as I was lucky enough to attend the Far From Ordinary Roadshow in New York City and interviewed Mark on the streets. However, technology failed me and the recording was not acceptable. Luckily, Mark was kind enough to take time out of his very busy schedule to sit down with me again so that I can share the wines of Australia with you. I am a huge fan, and I think that if you try these premium wines that are really $20 to $50 range, you will become a fan also. Enjoy. Sláinte. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass, sponsored by Dracena Wines. I'm your host, Lori, a UC Davis winemaking graduate and WSET Level 2 graduate. Today on Allure of the Pour, I am sitting down with Mark Davidson, who is the Education Manager for North America at Wines of Australia. So uncork, unscrew, or savor your favorite bottle and sit down and enjoy the conversation. So hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Hi, Lori. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your, I'm sure, very, very busy day in order to talk with me.
My pleasure. Always happy to talk wine.
Yes.
That's not a stretch.
So we actually met, you were in New York City, and I went to the Wines of Australia in New York City, and it was incredible. Let me just get that out of the way. Not only the rooms themselves, which were incredible, but the actual the wine blew my mind. And I have to share this with you because I kind of blame you for this. The day after the New York event. At the New York event, the winery you took me to say, this is where you have to start off.
Can't beat that. It's a great place to start any day, really, isn't it?
So, you brought me to, and am I pronouncing it correct? Is it Jans?
Yeah, it's Jans. Correct. Jans. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is from Tasmania, but you brought me there, and I have to admit, I kind of went back a couple of times after you left me. And the very next day, I went online on a mad hunt to find this wine, and I bought the last six bottles that was at Wine Chateau.
Perfect. And my job's done.
And it might have been the longest week of my life for it to get delivered. It was only 15 miles away from me, but they were like, no, we're going to deliver it. And it took a week for them to deliver it 15 miles. But I'm down to three.
Eventually, though.
Yes. Awesome. I'm down to three bottles. So I'm going to have to go through the whole process again and find another location. But before we get into the wines of Australia, you can share a little bit about yourself. How did you come to become Education Manager of the Wines of Australia?
Oh, good. It's a convoluted path, but I guess I was at school. I was not one of those kids that knew what they wanted to do. I think I wanted to go surfing and hang out with girls, I think, when I was asked by the counselor. But I did get into restaurants at a young age and kind of found the energy and the there was sort of a dynamism, I think, in restaurants that I enjoyed. So I got into a hotel and restaurant management program in Sydney, where I grew up, and actually started in kitchens, made my way to the front of the house, ended up sort of bartending and serving and working on the floor. and then just did a wine course one day because I was sort of vaguely interested and thought, oh, this would be kind of fun. I'm selling this stuff. This might be fun. And that was it. The door was open. It was a really simple thing, like learning that, oh, wow, Puy Frise is actually made from Chardonnay. Why does it taste different from that California Chardonnay I'm selling? And that was it. Door was open, and I kind of flew right in there, did my sommelier diploma. Then I moved around a bit. I was in Toronto for a bit, and then I was in Vancouver. And when I was in Vancouver, I set up a wine education school while I was still working in restaurants. Ended up teaching wine classes for a long period of time, went through WSET, did all those works, did the diploma fairly long time ago. And then was ending up teaching, doing a little bit less work in restaurants, ended up teaching for the International Sommelier Guild many years ago in both in the US and in Canada. And then I got approached. I was doing a seminar at one point, and the people from Wine Australia approached me and said, hey, we have a job for you. There's, you know, it was almost 10 years ago now. And we have a bit of an issue with the image of Australian wine right now, and we want to get down and do some grassroots programs to get people thinking correctly about Australian wine. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a cool project. So, yeah, that's sort of how I got there. So this is sort of the Coles Notes version of it. But, yeah, hospitality pretty much all the way, and then wine and wine education.
So they had to twist your arm to take the job, right?
Actually, initially they did.
Really?
I was doing something else. Well, only because it was a US-based position initially, and I was living in Vancouver. My daughter was at an age where it was like, oh, I'm not going to move. So they kept coming back to me, and we managed to make it work out of Vancouver for a while. I did end up moving to the States for a period of time. Then the carrot that was always dangled was that I can do this job globally, and I went around and worked with all the global teams for a few years, which is great as that was. It does wear on you after a while, all the travel, but love that. Got to see what the rest of the world is doing, not just with Australian wine, but wine in general. And yeah, so but now I'm back to focusing on North America. So still get up to Canada from time to time, but mostly the US.
Yeah, the you know, I live bi-coastal, and people are like, oh, that must be so great. You're always in the air. And I'm like, yeah, I'm always in the air. Yeah.
I love people that say to me they love business travel. Man, you just haven't done enough of it. Nobody loves business travel. You manage business travel.
Right. It takes a lot. And I guess it really wouldn't be so bad if you could just poof yourself on the plane and poof yourself off of the plane. But getting to the airport, the delays, the, you know, the missed connections, yeah. All of that stuff.
Yeah.
Real fun.
Cancel flight, missed connection. Anyway, it's all good fun, though. But we shouldn't complain. It's a pretty dynamic, fun business, though.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's get into Australia a bit. So the U.S. is Australia's second largest export market. So approximately how much of the percentage of the wines are actually exported versus how much are they keeping because they love their wine?
Oh, I wish I had those figures off the top of my head, and I probably should, because you did ask me this last time and I probably should know this. But I think there's a little bit of a myth. A good proportion of Australian wine is exported. I think there's always been a little bit of a myth that, oh, I go down to Australia and I try all these amazing wines, and people say, I think you keep all your best wines down there. Well, I actually don't. That's not actually 100% true. There are some small boutique-y wineries that you're less likely to see anywhere exported because they're just so small and they're sold domestically. You could apply that to pretty much any country. But right now we're sitting in a really good place globally, but specifically in the US, with a lot of people entering the market either for the first time or again. And we've just seen a lot of increased exports to the US at a higher price point, which has been a really positive thing for us, which has been the goal we've had since I started with the organization, which is, you know, get people drinking better and, you know, higher quality Australian wine. So I'd say I wish, honestly, I should have those numbers. I can certainly get them to you, but it's we do export a fair bit.
Yeah. So I going back to the high quality and a little bit higher price point, I personally think this Jance is incredible, and I adore it, and it would be my house sparkling if I could get more of it. And I only paid $21 a bottle for it. So, I mean, that when I was going online to look to purchase it, I was like, oh, this is going to cost me a pretty penny. This is going to cost me a pretty penny. And when I saw $21, I was like, yep, clear the shelves. You know, it's
well,
incredible.
Yeah, it is. Really, I think that is the nice thing. And I think, I mean, obviously there's exceptions that prove the rule, but the reality is right now in Australia, I think you drink very well at what would be considered still premium prices, but we're not talking, you know, wallet busting prices, in that $15 to $40 price range. Oh man, the whole country opens up basically. And like you say, you know, you've got a Tasmanian sparkling wine, made with Chardonnay Pinot and Pinot Meunier, same grapes they're using in Champagne. And it's mid twenties. I mean, you've got it for 21. I see it floating around the country for somewhere between 21 and 26. So that's the price point for that wine, and it's amazing.
And after I left the Far From Ordinary event, I did do a little more research and finding Australian bottles. They really are very price friendly, I should say. You know,
for sure.
And I think that
what they deliver, even at a really premium end, is incredible value for money. And I think you can apply that from 25 to 40, above 40. You know, wines that are pushing $100, they're just, you know, what they're delivering for they're over delivering in many cases. And I say that, you know, as a wine lover of global wines, I think what Australia's doing right now is amazing. It's really exciting.
Yes. So we met at what the event was called was Far From Ordinary Roadshow, and you had a very busy month. You were traveling for pretty much a month straight, right?
That was a big event in New York that kicked off a 6-city campaign, which was a roadshow that went around the U.S. Started in New York, went to Chicago, then to Miami, Dallas, L.A., San Francisco. And then there was a big sort of trade-only event that we did in Lake Tahoe, which culminated, sort of tidied up the entire thing. But it was not quite connected to the roadshow, but it was still connected to this sort of campaign of immersion in Australian wine.
Oh, Lake Tahoe. Ooh, if you can remember my name for that one next year, that is awesome. Okay, so the Far From Ordinary Roadshow demonstrated so many different, so much of an array of wines, so much that they offer, so much more than just Sauvignon Blanc, you know, and the Australian government has actually now given $50 million into the endeavor of educating the world, I guess, that Australian wines are so much more than the little critter guy that has been around, and really the cheaper, or I don't want to say cheaper, lower tier wines that are out there. So
yeah,
that's pretty incredible that the government is willing to do that.
Yeah, it's great. It's a really we were super excited. We're actually coming to the end of it. We've had access to additional funds for the last few years, and it culminates in what we've done here, and also some programs in China, because China and the US really got the focus of the funds. But yeah, it is. It's amazing, and I think what we've done with it has been pretty exciting. It is probably important to remember that prior to this, we were working on different sort of levies and what have you. And the reality is that if you compare what government funding we get for wine promotion to compare to Italy, Spain, Portugal, we're not even in the game, even with that additional money. And that's not a complaint. Just a reality check is that we've not been funded in that sort of a way. We don't have them. So. Historically, we've always been very frugal and done really cool things with not a lot of money. So when we did get some money, we blew it out of the water, I think. We did some really, really good, impactful events and activations, and I was extremely proud. I've been in the wine business a long time, but I was incredibly proud of what the country of Australia, the winemakers, and my team at Wine Australia did over the last sort of 6 weeks. It's pretty amazing.
And the part of the roadshow was educational. So now you did have a trade section, a trade portion of it, but then you did have a consumer portion of it. And this education seminars that you were offering to the trade, what were some of the highlights of what, you know, if you had to bullet, you know, point maybe three things that you want out there to the world about Australian wines, what would these seminars trying to get through?
Good point, because we're trying to cover off different subject matters and change it around a little bit from city to city. In New York, we talked about cool climates, the attitude and altitude. Attitude, altitude, and oceans. So the attitude's important in Australia for sure. So I guess to encapsulate in three things, it's kind of hard I guess, because there's so many things to talk about. Marketing types don't like the word diversity, but that's the reality. I think quality, diversity, and probably just there's a character and a personality to Australians making wine that I think it transfers into how the wines feel and how the wines taste, which I think is important. So I think character, quality, and personality would be the three things that we were trying to drive home in that, you know, and as I've said more than once, it's not like Australia doesn't have indigenous grape varieties. They've all come from elsewhere. The winemaking techniques we use, there's been a lot of innovation, a lot of new things that have happened, but generally speaking, they're adaptations of things that are being used elsewhere. Grapes have been grown in sometimes in different ways, but for the most part, it's viticulture that's globally sort of adapting and moving around. But yet, our wines taste different. You know, our varieties grown in parts of Australia don't taste the same in other parts of Australia, never mind around the world. So what are the characteristics? And I do think how Australia is, like the landscape and the environment, but also a very, very important piece of the puzzle is how we are as people, how we were settled as a country, and how we interact with, you know, culturally with wine. I think it's really important. I think it comes through in the wines.
So going back to Australia, the as a community, right, you said that there are no indigenous grapes to Australia. Is there a link to who decided, hey, it might be good to grow some grapes here and start that? Is that documented anywhere?
Yeah, sure. It's there's a lot of people that were bringing grapes with the first fleet. I always want to say first fleet of settlers, but everyone wants to correct me and call them convicts, but whatever, it's just a term. But realistically, they grapes were brought out with the first fleet of settlers or convicts. But what was probably more impactful were the people who deliberately went about trying to make quality to wine. There was, you know, Governor Blaxland and various others. But the guy that they pretty much always go back to would be a guy called James Busby, who was a botanist who went back to – he went over to work on the colonization in the early 1800s, went back in the 1830s, went back to Europe and systematically collected vine cuttings from around Europe, went to France because that was the most famous place at the time in those days, did collect grapes on the way back through on South Africa when they were sailing. And that was that. All those grapes got back into Australia in about 1832. So the primary big collection of grape vine species came then, and he made duplicate cuttings, and they went up to his farm in the Hunter Valley at that point, what is now Hunter Valley. And then they made their way around to all the colonies as they were expanding. And so what we end up having is this amazing collection of grape vines back from, you know, that are still, some of which are still from that, can trace their origins to the Busby collection in the 1830s. So now we've got this treasure trove of vines in Australia, which is amazing because we haven't had phylloxera, so it's been amazing.
Right, that's a knock on wood.
Well, it's in little places, but we're trying to be careful and cautious around it, but yes.
So do you think that your soils are the same types of soils that we have here. So, you know, like Santorini doesn't have phylloxera, but it's really not the vines. It's the fact that the phylloxera can't live in that soil. Is there
That's
anything
part of
you
it
think?
I think sandy soils that don't transfer. I think our soils are actually really ancient soils. They're old. It's the oldest geological formations exist in Australia. But I think there's two things at play. I think one is that the phylloxera hasn't. There's a few things at play that why phylloxera hasn't expanded, because it has been in Australia, and they do have little bits and pieces of, you know, outbreaks in Australia, but it's never been in certain states. And I think the other thing too is that if you've got sandy soils, it doesn't transfer as easily.
Right.
We don't have, you know, our regions are sometimes far apart, as opposed to parts of, say, Italy or Spain or Portugal or France, where it's contiguous. It's easier for a spread. And we've got very strict quarantines in states. So I think that's part of why we've managed to maintain it and manage it. And right now there's very, very, very cautious phylloxera infestation zone practices where, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who went and did harvest in the Yarra Valley where there is flock, and he said he spent all his days helping out, basically washing stuff all day long. Wash cars' tires when they come from one vineyard to another, spraying them, buckets, bins, everything. So there's a lot of care and maintenance that goes into that. So.
That was something I remember when I was doing my studies, that, you know, you don't really think that it's going to spread through a tire, you know, and that's really a big thing. So, you know,
farm equipment's one of the worst.
Right. Farm equipment. And then, hey, my neighbor needs, you know, to borrow my tractor or whatever. And whoop, there it goes right across to the next farm.
There it is.
Right. It's scary stuff, but it's. I'm glad it's not an issue there. So white wine production is Australia's largest market, followed by the red in a close second. And then there's even this portion of this wonderful sparkling wine. What are the major grape varieties that people can expect in Australia? And,
It's broad, but no, you can trim it down to the classic varieties, and then I always look at it with classing and emerging. And by emerging, it doesn't mean these varieties I'll tell you about in a minute haven't been there for a while. It's just that they're starting to emerge as being more significant players. But white variety, the Chardonnay is the most planted white variety in Australia right now. You've got, I think actually the most planted variety is Shiraz, followed by Chardonnay, followed by Cabernet. And then it's a bit of a mishmash of various varieties. You know, Pinot Noir is actually up there, Merlot and some other classic varieties. And then it's just, there's literally just over 100 commercially significant varieties in Australia.
Oh.
So there's a lot. The diversity is really there. And I think that's also something I've been trying to, sort of a message I've been trying to drive home is that, yeah, for sure, the most planted varieties and the most prominent varieties we know and love, they're out there. And that doesn't tell the whole picture. You know, it's like saying, I don't know, pick any country. It's like, you know, yes, we love Italy, but they only grow Sangiovese, right? It's like, well, we know that's not true. but, you know, dominant for sure, Shiraz, Chardonnay, and Cabernet. And then you can then find the edges of a lot of really cool stuff.
Shiraz is probably the number one red?
Yeah, and the most planted variety, period. We've got 140,000 hectares thereabouts. Those figures always go up and down. It's just a bit under 140,000 hectares, and about 43,000 hectares is Shiraz, and it's grown in virtually every region across the country.
So I get this asked all the time of me, and I really don't have an answer to it. Why do they stick, or I should say, why do we stick, whichever, but why are they sticking to Shiraz versus Syrah? Do you think that poses, when it comes abroad, when it comes domestic to the United States, do you think that adds to some confusion, or are they want to stick to it because it's their heritage?
Oh, I think actually now we pretty much own the term Shiraz, and it's because it's been there for such a long time that people now, they associate it. And actually not everywhere is calling it Shiraz anymore. There are some places calling it Syrah and some producers using the term Syrah as the distinguishing point, but I'll come back to that in a minute. But no, I think there's the origins of that variety are much debated. There was a period of time where they thought that actually the origins were around the what was then the Persian town of Shiraz. Therefore, that's actually since been disproven. But the point is, if you look at old documentation in Australia, the old reports of cuttings and what have you, Siras or Sirkast was something that was in there as well, and it sort of got shortened and chopped and changed as language tends to do, especially the English language, which, you know, is arguably the most bastardized language on the planet. With origins in everywhere, we just ended up with Shiraz that has stuck for the most part. But that being said, Yarra Valley is making what many people in Yarra Valley are calling it Syrah. And when quizzed on that, I always thought, well, is this more complicated? And they said, but the biggest problem usually is domestic, in that if people pick up a bottle of Shiraz and they're expecting a richness and a ripeness and a certain style that they may be more accustomed to, they may be disappointed in Yarra because Yarra is more medium weight, cool climate. Mm-hmm. Shiraz, therefore, is a different expression, and that's why they typically use the word Syrah. I'm in two minds about what I think about that. Right. I'd like to live in the world of, like, hey, if you want a cool climate, you're out from Australia, go to Yarra Valley. We're not quite there yet.
And that's actually what I have been hearing, is that the Australian winemakers are choosing to call it Syrah versus Shiraz, depending on what their stylistic version of that wine totally. Is.
Yeah, a more restrained medium white wine that would be a bit more sort of savory and red fruited. People tend to towards, but it's not really the same across the board. But generally speaking, it's like a little bit akin to the whole Pinot Grigio approach in the New World, where if you're making a Northern Italian style, a light crisp style, you'd label it Pinot Grigio, and if you're making a fuller, richer style, you'd say Pinot Gris. But I mean, even that's not really clear cut. But yeah, that's happening in Australia now a little bit, which just adds to the complexity and the fun and interest. But yeah, so but mostly I'd say probably even at this point 9 out of 10 holes of Shiraz, if not more, of Shiraz, you pick them up and it'll play Shiraz on the label rather than Syrah.
And so, the people in Australia, are they kind of focusing in for consumption? Is there a favorite grape variety for their consumption in terms of sales within the country?
I don't have the exact numbers, but I know that for whatever people say about Shiraz and Chardonnay, they're still the most, I would argue, they're still the most popular varieties. Same thing with people said anything but Chardonnay in the US, and then you look at the numbers and it was everything but, nothing but Chardonnay was it was going. But so I think there's a bit of that going on. But what I will say that is happening in Australia, and I think it's a global shift. I think people are far more apt to experiment and not nearly as varietally or even brand loyal as they used to be. They're just happy to experiment. What you'll see nowadays in Australia is people trying all sorts of really cool and different things and very, very happy to do so. And I was like, I'm sticking to my Shiraz from this particular region. They're just, they're happy to experiment and try different things now. And I think that's really cool.
And are the winemakers, there's the GSM, but then they're, for here we have GSM, but then people are putting, Petit Verdot, or they're like mad scientists. Like, let's see, what can we throw in to, make these wines intriguing and interesting and funky? Is that going on in Australia also?
Oh, it's happening, yeah. All the cool, hip, trendy things you're seeing anywhere else in the world have been happening in Australia along very similar lines. I think there's a few things emerging that I'm seeing, which I'm, because I think it's really hard to, in the last 10 years and watching Australia evolve, as you do with any country. I've been in this, doing this for a long time, and Burgundy was one of my favorite places, and that's why I got into the business. And while the appellations haven't changed and different things, have remained static, the style of Burgundy has evolved and changed. And when I was a young sommelier trying to buy basic Bourgogne Rouge, forget it. It was not really drinkable. Now, all of a sudden, basic Bourgogne. So everything changes and moves. And so I think that's, true of every country. But the one thing, if there is something that I'm seeing, I don't like to pinpoint one thing, but there's a freshness. And you probably saw that when you were tasting through, is that there's just this vibrancy and energy in the wines of, like, whether it doesn't matter what variety, what region, there's sort of an energy and freshness to the wines, which I think is really cool. And when you investigate this, if it's possible to investigate, I'm always kind of curious. You go to Barossa, you go to McLaren Valley. This was pointed out to me in McLaren Valley, a warm climate region, very Mediterranean climate. And a lot of the guys saying, look, we look at our climate, and there's a certain time of year we got richer and full-bodied reds. But for the most part, 8 to 9 months of the year, look at our climate. Look at what we eat. We want vibrance and juicy, fresh. So even from varieties like Grenache, which is one of my pet favorites right now, you can have a beautiful, big, full-bodied, age-worthy style of Grenache from McLaren Vale, or you can have a light, juicy, almost Pinot-esque style, and anything in between. And that could be suited to all sorts of different cuisines. So I feel like some of the wine styles are being shaped a little bit around lifestyle as much as it is. And sometimes less about variety, it is about style. And we're seeing that with globally with the natural wine movement. Sometimes what's in the wine, who cares? It's a style, which I think is kind of cool.
Right. And I think people are willing to try different things, try some, oh, I've never heard of this before. All right, I'm going to try it. Oh, I've never, tasted this before. I'm going to try it.
Yeah. There's a guy who's up in the Adelaide Hills that I love this one because it's a little bit of fun too, because he's taking a bit of a sort of a page or maybe, you know, making some fun with the whole vin de soif in France, which is a, you know, a drinking wine, and he calls it his vin de sofa. And it's absolutely delicious. And I asked him what's in it, and he said, oh, it doesn't matter, because it's like 15 different varieties. It's a style. There's some Pinot, there's some this, there's some Gewürz, there's a whole bunch of other things. And like, who cares what's in it? It's about what is one you sit back on the sofa and drink. I thought, oh, that's cool. Vin de soif or vin de sofa? I'll take the vin de sofa, please.
There you go. There's a winery in Paso that is very, well, I don't know how you can say well-known, but if you're in that area, well known for their very risque labels, let's say. Some labels that I don't know how they get past the TTB, you know, and get their cola. But they have a Bueno Sofa. And it's kind of it's the kitchen sink wine. You know, it's the kitchen sink.
It's fun. I mean, I think it's funny. We think we're really inventive in the wine business, and in some areas we are, in the viticulture and in winemaking, but it's really funny how we're still all on 750ml bottles with corks in them. And so I think it's nice to see some people having some fun and making some, you know, and that's happening in Australia, and it's a really exciting time as well, because it adds to the complex tapestry that is whatever's going on in a particular country, and that's what's happening in Australia. It's great.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracenaWines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank. So this is going to be kind of a rough question because we could spend weeks and weeks studying this and learning about this. But just in a very brief way, can you give a description of the main regions of like what somebody can expect from the main region, like a warm climate, cool climate? They're more known for Pinot, they're more known for this.
I'll do the best I can, and I'll try and maybe separate. I like the idea of warm versus cooler climate because we have both in Australia. So, and I'll look at, you know, just consider maybe what's mostly available in the US because, you know, we have 65 different regions in Australia.
Right, yeah.
Some you'll never see here in the US. It's just not going to happen. So I'll talk about the major, maybe I'll sort of break down the top half dozen or so. So for warm climate or warmer climate wines, we could look at, you know, Barossa Valley, McLaren Vale, probably Coonawarra, I think, are three, and the Clare Valley. Clare Valley is a bit sort of borderline. The Barossa Valley, famous for Shiraz, really good Grenache, home to some of the oldest Shiraz, Grenache, Mourvèdre vines on the planet, never mind anything else. Really unique in that they were settled by Germans. The German expansion there was really, like if you think about the names, Henschke, Dutschke, you know, Lehmann. So really cool German influences that's really had an impact, a profound effect on the wine and food culture there. And yes, it's warm climate. Doesn't mean all the wines are big and full-bodied. Some are, and you can see some real restraint happening now through, you know, viticultural practices and picking a bit earlier. But I think Barossa would be a classic, you know, it's not, I don't like to make the comparison of Napa, but it's kind of like our Napa Valley, if you like.
Okay.
Not quite, but whatever, you know. Then you've got McLaren Vale, which is similar in some cases, but it's definitely much more maritime influence. It's only an hour or two, be a 2-hour drive from Barossa. similar varieties, Grenache and Shiraz, doing very well, but, you know, just a slightly different kind of flavor profile and character in those wines. And the very cool thing that's happening, you see this a lot in other regions, but very specifically in McLaren Vale, experimentation with other varieties, mostly southern Mediterranean varieties, with an eye to looking at climate change and what varieties hold on to acidity and freshness in warmer climates. So if you're in McLaren Vale these days, in the summertime, you're drinking Fiano, Vermentino, or Nera d'Avila, or Sagrantino, and they're actually, and that's not just a little gimmicky thing. It's something that's been going on for the last 10 or 15 years, and it's not done because people thought, oh, it should be easy to sell Vermentino from McLaren Vale. Not at all. It's about planting varieties that long-term might end up being more suited, certainly with white varieties. That's kind of an exciting thing. So in terms of a warm climate region, McLaren Vale is a really exciting place to be right now. While we're still hovering around South Australia and Adelaide, you can literally 15 minutes from the downtown core of Adelaide, you can be in the Adelaide Hills. And while you will see Shiraz and Chardonnay and varieties that are, you know, you might know, that's actually one of the cooler climates in South Australia. You're getting elevation. You're going up 400 meters. So you're getting cooler climate, good sparkling wine, good Chardonnay, actually a really good place for Pinot Noir, arguably one of the best places in South Australia for Pinot Noir. So right there in the space of an hour or two, you can be in warm climate and cool climate, and that's kind of exciting. There's so many. How often we've got, I think, in South Australia, there'd probably be the two or three most famous, with also a little bit further south of Adelaide, you get into Coonawarra, okay, which is just Cabernet country, period. It's one of our famous, I mean, that's our Napa Valley strip, if you like, of like famous Cabernet. But then actually, you know, so that would be a flight into Adelaide, and you could see all of that around you, and even maybe make a quick trip up to the Clare Valley and drink some ridiculously gorgeous Riesling.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a region that's starting to cool and warm. Victoria, into the state of Victoria, because people don't know the states much in Australia, but the state of Victoria, Melbourne's the largest city, and in and around Melbourne, we are in the dress circle of Pinot Noir production. And that's where it's exciting for Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and cooler climate varieties. Again, a glib assessment, but Yarra Valley, brilliant for Chardonnay, brilliant for Pinot. Same for Mornington Peninsula, with a more heavy accent on Pinot, as in 50% of the vineyard land's planted to Pinot. And anywhere around there is brilliant for both of those varieties, along with other things too. It's not like it's a monovarietal look to those regions. But yeah, Yarra's pretty exciting and very accessible, and what we're talking there is cooler climate for sure. Where else can we go? Major city of Sydney. You're going to be heading up to Hunter Valley, 2 hours from Sydney. Hunter Valley, famous for definitely the most unique expression of Semillon anywhere on the planet. These wines are light-bodied but can age for decades and turn into a really, really special sort of style and become sort of a unique gift to the world as far as I'm concerned. And you've got Shiraz, but Shiraz with a slightly different look and feel to it than you would find in Barossa or McLaren Vale, in that they're more medium-bodied, more savoury, more red-fruited from Hunter Valley than they are in say, Barossa or McLaren.
Are we getting any late harvest Semillon coming?
You can. It's not a huge thing, but there's one famous one from De Bordoli called Noble One, which comes from the river Riverina area down in southern part of New South Wales, the state of New South Wales, and it's magnificent. Not a lot, though. We've got our sweet wines. We've got some late harvest wines, and our sweet wines are very, very good, but we don't have a lot of Botrytis. It's drier in Australia, so Botrytis isn't really you've got to be in the right spot, and you'll find the example of our sweet wines. Our famous sweet wines are fortifieds. We've had a long history of fortified. One more quick trip. We have to go right across the country because you cannot have this discussion. There's two more places we're going to go to, actually. Got to go across to Margaret River, which is in Western Australia, one of the most famous regions for Cabernet in Australia, but also year in, year out for the last 20 years, the most awarded Chardonnays in Australia have come out of Margaret River. So brilliant place for Chardonnay and Cabernet. And then there's Tasmania. There's just something about Tasmania that is captivating in general. Captivating to North Americans especially. I think it's the Bugs Bunny cartoon, not 100% sure. But I'm pretty sure there's a bit of fascination.
It could be. I'm personally fascinated because of Tanzanite. I mean,
now you're drinking though. You're drinking Tasmanian.
Yes.
Now,
so yes.
But that's exciting territory right now because there's been a lot of plantings there. Well, actually, it's not a lot. I shouldn't say that. There's been plantings in Tasmania for many years, but it's been small, and it still is small. I think we might be hovering at about 1,600 hectares right now compared to the national, but more and more people are sneaking down there, buying property. I know many wineries from the mainland that are very excited about the, not just potential, but also with climate change. And this is what people are doing, not just in Australia, but globally. Where are we going to go next? Because, you know, we have to go up or get closer to the ocean. So now I know a Yarra Valley producer, a guy I know up in the Yarra, just bought a property in Tasmania, which historically people go, you're nuts, it's too cold, it's too far south, it's too cold. He doesn't think so. He hasn't planted it yet, but he's looking at this going, we can make something work here, and it's very, very exciting. And Tasmania is just, it's like nowhere else in Australia too. It's a very unique, beautiful island. It's, you know, unbelievably pristine, and yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot because nobody can say they have any, you know, one child is better than the other. They love them all equally. But do you
some
have
more equally than others?
Yes, yes. Which one is a little bit more equal in your mind to your palate? So I'm not even saying anything else to your palate, which is a little bit higher.
Oh man, in my job with wine industry, I love all regions equally and all wineries the same. No, obviously we have our things we're excited about. I couldn't just put it down to one thing, but I do think there's a couple of categories potentially that it might be exciting. And I think, as mentioned, Grenache, I think what we are doing with Grenache right now, I just did a presentation in Montreal that's on 360, and everyone was like, wow, that's amazing. And it's been something happening for the last 10 years, which is this full show of what Barossa and McLarenville can now do with Grenache. It's a really exciting proposition, largely because I think, especially we've been in the business for a while, and you go, oh, I know what Grenache is. It fits into this little narrow sort of frame, right? It's full-bodied, it's alcoholic, it's this. Well, if you...
Let's try this again.
And I like it when we have rediscoveries like that. So now you're seeing a full spectrum of all the different faces, the sort of ethereal, perfumed, and aromatic side of Grenache, along with the full-bodied and spicy side, which I think is exciting. Pinot and Chardonnay, two classic varieties that everyone knows globally. We've never been in a better place than we are right now with both of those varieties right now. You know, finding the best zones for them, the best, you know, vineyards within those right sort of climate zones for both those varieties. And we're now making beautiful, balanced, detailed and delicate examples of those wines across the country. And frankly, as boring as this might sound to some people, you know, go back and look at Shiraz. What we're doing with that variety and always have done, never mind how that's evolved, you've got to remember it's grown in every single region that we have in Australia, some to a lesser degree than others. But there's no place on the planet that can show the full spectrum of what that variety is capable of producing than we can. It's just that most people don't know that because they think, oh, yeah, I've had Shiraz. It's either soft and fruity or big and full-bodied and spicy. Well, they exist and will always exist, but everything in between, seeing the aromatic, beautiful examples coming out of cooler climates, I think it's a really exciting time to go back. And there was a Kellogg's Cornflakes commercial. I can't remember where it was. It said, try us again for the first time. I just love that. I think it's so good. It's like, you know, we all know it, but yeah, we know what it's like. It's over here, but like, go back and have a look at it again. And I thought that was a really cool place to look at it. But anyway, I can't just say one thing, but there are certain regions I love to visit that just tweak with you. I do love visiting the Yarra Valley. There's just something about the diversity there, its proximity to a major city that I think has inspired the food and the wine and the culture in the region. I love Margaret River as well. It's the most remote region you'll ever go to. It's like three or four hour drive south of Perth, and when you get there, it's like, whoa, where am I? This is just so totally beautiful and totally different.
So if somebody was,
I said it, I have favorites.
There you go. if somebody was planning a wine trip to Australia, what would you say would be the minimum amount of time that they should be dedicated to get a good feeling of what we've got going on here?
Oh, I don't think you can do any serious damage in less than 2 weeks. You'd need a couple of weeks. But I think if you're going to make your way down to Australia, at least try and have about 3 weeks. Because obviously you don't want to just do wine, even though I'm happy to just do wine all the time. I think you need at least 2 weeks. And I'd say 3 weeks would be ideal. It'd be like, I don't know, it's like saying, you know, you've just got, even just take the West Coast, you've got Washington State, Oregon, and California. How much time for just those three states to have a look at would you say would be appropriate? Like a week in each would be great, but obviously that's harder to do. But yeah, I'd say if you can get 2 weeks and fly to one of the major cities, like Adelaide's a really good place to kick off a wine journey in Australia, simply because hour and a half north to Barossa, 2 hours north of Adelaide, you're in Clare, Eden Valley, Adelaide Hills, McLaren, all around there. And there's some pretty famous regions. You can get a lot done in 2 weeks there. And then again, Melbourne, same thing. You can drag yourself away from the excitement that is Melbourne. You can be in the Yarra Valley in 45, well, depends on traffic, but technically 45 minutes, and the same just traveling south to Mornington Peninsula, where you can, you know, you can have a morning surf and have a Pinot Noir at lunch. It's perfect.
That sounds good. So then that would be two focal points. You could go into Adelaide, spend a couple, you know, spend a week there, and then fly out and go to Melbourne, fly to Melbourne.
Didn't go to Melbourne and catch a lot of really cool stuff, or drive, do the Great Ocean Road.
What's that drive about?
It's a bit long. Yeah, it's about 1,000 kilometers. Probably, yeah, no, you wouldn't want to do that in 2 weeks, but a lot of good stuff to see in the in-betweens. But yeah, I think those two focal points would be great. I mean, it's hard because there's just so much to see in two, and it would require a couple of trips. But I'd say in 2 weeks you could do a week to 10 days in Adelaide, and you could spend a 5 to 7 days in around Melbourne, and you can see a lot. Get a good sense of it too. You get a good sense of what's happening with warm climate in certain varieties and cool climate in certain varieties. You get a good – when I take trips down there and I'm doing one again in the spring, that's typically how we would do it, you know, a week or so, and just a little bit over a week in South Australia, either Tasmania, Margaret River in there, or we head up to the Yarra Valley and Mornington and have a look around there.
And if somebody was planning their trip there, are the wineries typically open to the public without an appointment? They need an appointment? Are you...
Depends. There's plenty of places where you can just show up and, we still aren't at that point like they are at Napa where they're charging for tastings. You can pretty much show up to most wineries and get involved in the tasting. But some are not open. Some you do need to make an appointment. But certainly there's plenty of wineries in every region that I can think of where you can just show up and during, obviously, the correct hours, and you can just taste and get a sense of the place.
So they have tasting rooms... They have tasting rooms similar to...
We call them cellar doors.
Oh, I like that better.
Yeah.
I like that better.
Tasting. Well, it's the same thing, but we just call it cellar. You know, we just sell that from cellar door, and you go, what? That's the expression in Australia. So, yeah, plenty of cellar doors where you can just show up and taste.
Okay. So in terms of production, the average winery... you know, in terms of production, I'm sure there's small wineries and large production wineries, but your general bulk, like what's that case production that somebody can expect from?
Well, it just depends. I mean, I think we're starting to see, I think that dynamic has changed a lot in the last 10 years. A lot of real small boutique wineries that have sprung up, some that have already been around for a while. I know plenty of really exciting wineries in Adelaide Hills that are 2,000 to 5,000 cases, which is small, and they're still exporting. I'd say there's quite a lot that sits at a small to medium-sized family-run businesses that sit in that 10,000 to 20,000 case production, so not super big. And then there's probably a bit of a jump. It's kind of hard to do it. I wouldn't say there's a particular zone, and we've got a couple of big companies that are producing large volumes, as there are in any country.
It'd
be hard to say. I think if you add it all up, you know, company by company, there'd be more companies making in and around the 10,000 to 20,000 case than there are anything else.
Okay.
So not big at all.
So, right. So that's what I was going to say is you tend to have more of the boutique-y, you know, wherever you go, you're going to have the, you know, the gallows, you're going to have that.
You've got your volume productions. Yeah, for sure.
And are most of them individual wineries, or do we have co-ops? Do we have, you know, like,
there's not so much, not like, it's not the same in the sense that we don't have, if we've got 140,000 hectares of vines, and I try to put that into perspective. Whilst Australia's known for some large brands like Yellowtail and some other big production wines, the reality is the vineyard under, the area under vine is that, is just a little bit less than Bordeaux and Burgundy combined.
Okay.
So it's not as big as people think. So the reality is it's not like we have these vast tracts of vineyard lands that require, and with small farmers requiring a co-op to produce. That's why a lot of the good co-ops in Europe have worked that way, is that the producers have been grape growers their entire lives, and they just, you know, go to a co-op. Doesn't really, we don't have that quite so much in Australia. So it's either grape growers selling to other wineries, and more, sometimes those grape growers, and, you know, someone that's been making, you know, Oliver's Taranga, they've been sixth generation grape growers, but for the last generation, they're grape growers and winemakers. They've started their own winery. So that tends to be a path that they would follow. So I think for the most part, you're not seeing co-ops in Australia. You've got some larger companies that are, you know, obviously either owning vineyards and buying from them, or you've got small to medium sized family run businesses.
Okay. Now, what about the trendy stuff? The organic wines, the natural wines, biodynamics. Is Australia diving into this?
Yeah, and we'll start with the biodynamics and organics. That's something that has been evolving and accelerating over the last 20 years or so. Although it's fairly safe to say there's a lot of really good producers. They've always been biodynamic. They just don't talk about it. They just don't feel like that's a marketing advantage to them. They just do it because they should, which you could argue both sides of that argument, I think. But, you know, I just think of Jasper Hill, Cullen, other wineries where they've always done that. It's not something they advertise. They'll talk about it if you ask them. But then even a sort of a larger family-run business, Yalumba, for example, has been organic and certified in some of their vineyards and practicing in some of their top vineyards biodynamics for the last 10 years as well. And they're a slightly larger company, still family-owned, but a larger company. So I think that's something accelerating, and also depends on region as to just how far-reaching that is. Go back to McLaren Vale again. A really great example of a, for want of a better term, green and sustainable region, in that they've got all manner of really good practices in play where pretty much everyone's on board to the very least of all organics, but sometimes biodynamics, but, you know, water recycling and stuff that they're using and stuff they're doing in the vineyards that is sustainable. It's a really exciting piece of the puzzle. So without a doubt, something that's accelerating. I don't have percentages and numbers, but it's a very important subject of discussion in Australia. Natural wines, yep, we got it going on. It's happening in different parts of the country. I have to say, I come from a classics background, so natural wine initially for me was a bit of a struggle. That being said, I'm excited about it. On one hand, I think, yeah, we can easily become grumpy old wine people, you know, and I just think there's something new and something evolving in this space that maybe want to stop and go, okay, what's the excitement here? And old is new again. And, you know, I think what we're seeing with the best natural producers in Australia right now is this sort of a fine tuning a bit, this recognition that, you know, maybe wine doesn't just quietly make itself in the corner. A little bit of help along is good, and making excuses for faulty wines is really not the future for natural wine. That's sort of an ethos or a sentiment that I'm getting as I'm sort of spending time with some of the best producers. And most of the guys I know and like and love what they're doing is like, we don't do anything, we don't add anything, nothing. We will minimal, but we'll put a bit of sulfur in it, bottling, and that's it. Simply because, hey, I'm not just selling this out my back door. I'm shipping and trucking this, and right. I feel like there's a duty of care to my customer. I'm seeing that as a bit of an evolution. I think we're seeing that everywhere, to be honest. And right. I think, you know, I love the concept of natural wines. It's made us stop and think about our perceptions. You've done study programs, the whole idea about color and clarity and texture. It's like, whoa, it's all, you know, throwing that on its ear. And I like that on one hand. I don't like excuses for poor, faulty wines.
Right.
But what we're seeing, I think, evolving nicely out of Australia is that the very best producers, in my humble opinion, are really, there's some exciting wines that make you go, ooh, that's not what I ever had from this region and this variety. Yeah. Kind of like it.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Now, along those lines, I like as I was researching the wines from Australia and all of that, that the government really does seem to be trying to help promote the wines themselves and the production of the wines, which I'm not so sure really occurs here. It's like regions do, you know, we get together as a community in Paso and we try to do the best we can. But like the Australian government is also funding research to help eliminate pests, to help.
Yeah, we're so lucky with the AWRI and another research institute, but certainly with AWRI, we've always been at the pointy end of the stick with a lot of really, really cool research. And I think that absolutely categorically benefits not just viticulture, but the industry as a whole, because there's experimentation and research in so many different areas. I mean, just go to the website, Australian Wine Research Institute, and just look at current projects, and it's just, and quite often when I have a group of SOMs down there, we'll, if we're in Adelaide for any length of time, we've got time there, I'll do a 2 or 3 hour session just touring around and sit down and talk about, okay, what's going on with, I don't know, smoke tank technology or what's going on with pests, what are the most, you know, significant pests that you're dealing with right now and how you're combating them. It's amazing. We're very lucky, and that's honestly, a lot of funding goes towards that for researchers, as it rightly should. So
that's wonderful. What do you think is Australian wine's biggest challenge today?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's a challenge generally globally, is in that I think one of the lovely things as a wine drinker these days is that there's never been a better time to drink wine. And I say that simply because when I got excited about the wine, there were a whole bunch of countries and or regions that were irrelevant that are no longer irrelevant. And we can just pick off the top. It's like when I was a young SOM in the 80s, Sicily, it was Corvo Bianco, Corvo Rosso, and a whole bunch of crappy Marsala. Not anymore. Okay. Sicily's about as exciting. Southern Italy, you just get Greek wine was all about red semen in those days. Now it couldn't be more exciting. So I think while that's a wonderful thing for the drinker, I think for any country or any region promoting wines, and I know you're involved in Paso, it's a crowded marketplace. Mm-hmm. That makes it, I think that, so if there's a challenge, it's like, well, there's a lot of good wine from everywhere now, and that's a brilliant thing on one hand and hard. I think one of the challenges that I'm, and I know this will change, it's just a matter of time. I still think there's a little bit of price point sensitivity when it comes to Australian wines, that people are happy to spend a certain amount, slowly but surely creeping up. And I got this a lot in the last sort of tour. I was in Canada this week, and it was in Montreal last week rather than, and then Toronto, and it was like, oh yes, but for that money we can get XYZ. And I just think it's, at a certain point people will stop saying that, like they did in the early days in Napa. People didn't want to spend $100-$150 on Napa cab. Now right. They don't even bat an eyelid. So it's just a question of building confidence and having, you know, anecdotally I told an interesting story about a sommelier who's got a wine bar, a master sommelier, a lovely guy in Florida. And he's selling an old vine Grenache that's $90 a bottle, and he's sending, like, I need as many cases as I can get. My customers love it. So get it in the glass, get it in people's mouths, they'll buy it.
Right, absolutely.
So I think price point sensitivity, I'd say price point sensitivity a little bit until people feel confident, and then more in a big thing. It's like, hey, it's a busy marketplace. We're all looking for people to pay attention to what we're doing. And luckily for the consumer, there's a lot, but not for us. It makes it much harder for us to find our little place. But you know, we're finding it, as you know, every country does.
And I think that is a big issue, is people are not willing to spend that extra $5-$10 on something that they're not familiar with, where once they get it in a glass, they're all for it.
Five cases of it. Look at you. Yep. If I said to you before you tried that wine, said, hey, you need to drink Tasmanian sparkling wine, you'd go, yeah, yeah, sure, whatever, in the way you went off to whatever you're most comfortable with. But you tried it, you were like, I've got to find this, I've got to get this, and now you've seen it, tried it. Because, I mean, it's like, you know, if you think about it, ultra premium. I mean, $21 isn't cheap, but it's not expensive either. But that's not what people are drinking on a daily. You can't get enough of it. And, you know, that's awesome. You know, that's just a great, that's it. Get it in your mouth and you go, yep, I'll buy that. Where we go.
Right. For me, $21 for that is well worth my $21. You know, you go to Starbucks and then people are spending $7 on a drink, right? You know, I mean, so
that's not nearly as much fun.
That is nowhere near what that is. Absolutely.
So true.
All right. So where can people find out more about the wines of Australia, social media wise, or your website, or where can they go to find out more?
Website for, I think we're really proud of a website that we've just developed. It's taken a long time for the education team to pull this together. It's called www.australianwinediscovered.com, and it's an education resource where you can just look at subjects. It's been broken down into the major subjects that it's sort of topical, I guess, is sort of the major varieties, major regions, and then topical things, all of which you can pull up a program on Grenache, and it's, you can download the PowerPoint, do what you want with it, and it's kind of yours. And never mind all the other information that's there. There's a lot of really cool information that's been turned into downloadable resources, and it's completely free, not password protected. You just go in there and take it.
So WSET people, get on board with that.
Every time I have an opportunity to show it to WSET or to Society of Wine Educators, like, get on there, and people are just like, oh, you mean I don't have to pay? No, it's free. Oh, so I don't have to pay? It's like,
we're not used to that. We're not used to
that. I like that we've done that and made that. It's reminds me of an annoying TurboTax ad. Free. It's like, yeah, it's free. So
right.
It's really cool, and we're super proud of that. And I encourage anyone to just go and look at what's happening there and download and just access, you know, all sorts of information. So I think that's probably the most valuable resource in the central place to look for it. So.
Wonderful. Is there anything that I have missed that you feel that you cannot leave this interview without letting people know about the wines of Australia?
No, I think we covered a lot. And if that hasn't inspired people to experiment, get out there and try either some, you know, go back and revisit some classics that you might be familiar with and see how they've evolved. And as I said, that's something I think people noted. I noted on the roadshow, which people like, oh, wow, I've actually sat and tasted a bunch of Barossa wines. This is not what I remember. I like what I'm tasting now. And I like that because some of, you know, old classics and comforting wines, isn't that they evolve and change, and then go out and experiment. I mean, man, if you see a Fiano from McLaren Vale, get it, drink it, you'll be happy.
Absolutely. I'm all for, you know what, I'm all for if there's a wine that you have not had, that's the only way for you to learn wine. You know, you can stick your nose in a book and you can learn, you know, memorize all of that stuff, whatever the book wants you to learn. But the best way to learn wine is to get it in your glass.
The real mileage is in the glass. You got to get it done.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So it is that time. Are you ready to play my little game of opposites?
I'm not so sure about this one, but sure.
Okay. It is super, super simple. I swear there is no right or wrong answer. It's just whichever pops in your brain, whichever one is more, you know, resonates with you more.
Okay.
Right. I'm going to start off with non-wine terms to kind of get us.
Pick an opposite?
I'm sorry, what?
I'm supposed to pick an opposite.
What I'm going to give you two terms, and you just say which one you like better.
Oh, okay, cool.
Easy. Okay. So we'll start off with non-wine terms to get us into the groove, and then I'll get into wine-related stuff. Okay?
Okay, good.
All right. So, night or day?
Day.
Sunset or sunrise?
Sunrise.
Black or white?
White.
Walk or run?
Run.
Old world, new world?
Stupid expressions.
Love it. Love it.
Completely invalid term and invalid way of separating the wine world. I'll say new world.
But I love that. That is true. Sweet or dry?
Depends. Dry.
Bubbles or still?
Still.
Oak or stainless?
Stainless.
Drink now, drink. Oh.
This is hard. Okay, yeah, stainless. Fine.
Okay, so actually I'm going to interfere my own game and break my rules and ask a question. Is there a general philosophy of, are most of the winemakers, you know, are for Grenache, let's say, or whatever, are we seeing barrel program, or is it stainless steel?
Depends on the variety, depends on the style. There's a definite, I think, that completely depends. Like Riesling, Semillon, a bunch of things are all stainless steel and inert vessels. What we're seeing more and more of, I think, for varieties that have typically seen oak, whether it be in fermentation and or maturation, you're seeing less new, larger format, more sort of, you know, older wood. And when it is new, it's higher quality and less, but high percentage. So general, like Chardonnay, yeah. Cab, you know, there's that.
And typically super French? General, I mean, generally...
Switching, yeah. It's all switching a lot over the last 10 years, switching from American to French. Not across the board, but there's a lot more French oak in Australia now.
Okay. All right. Back to the game. Okay. drink now or drink later?
Now.
Blend or varietal?
Oh, come on.
Depends on the weekday.
Blend. I'll say blend because that's my mood today.
Vintage or non-vintage?
Vintage.
Cork or screw cap?
Screw cap.
Napa or Sonoma? Or should I say like Barossa or McLaren?
I'd say Sonoma. To the first one, I'd say Sonoma.
Okay. Commercial or indigenous?
Indigenous. I'm presuming you're talking about fermentation.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Bordeaux or Rhone?
Oh, damn. Rhone.
Warm climate or cool climate?
Cool.
Awesome. That's it. I'm going to have to, like, add two Australian regions in there now, since I've got the Napa, Sonoma, Bordeaux, or Rhone. I'm going to have to add the two to Australian regions. But thank you so much for taking your time again. And again, I apologize for the technical difficulties the first time.
Happy to redo.
I greatly appreciate it. And honestly, I'm so happy you were able to do it again, because I really was impressed with the wines across the board. There really wasn't a single wine that I tasted that I did not think was a quality wine that night.
Good, and, thank you.
So I really wanted to get the information out to people. So thank you very much. And
pleasure. I'll have to come and see you at Paso. It's one of the failings in my wine travel career. I haven't been to Paso, and I've got to get that. I've got to sort that out. Short order.
Absolutely, absolutely. I will love to show you around. I am like the Paso host, man. People come, they're supposed to come to taste my wine, and after they taste my wine, I start taking them all over the place to all of the different areas.
My problem is that every time I've been in that part of the world, I've been surfing just nearby on the coast, and I always say like Cayucos and places like that. I'm like, oh, I should go to Paso.
Or I could surf. But it's
definitely, as so many times I've thought, it's time to visit Paso. So one of these days, soon, I promise.
Yes, well, please let me know. I would love to show you around. But
thank you.
Thank you. And one of these days, I'm going to get to Australia. I need to get rid of my full-time job on top of the winery so that I can have 3 weeks to get
That's
there.
That's the part, yeah.
And I have to honestly, everybody says to me, you know, you fly so much, you have so many miles. Don't you use your miles to fly back and forth to California? I said, no, my miles are staying in the bank for when I go to Australia. I can fly nicely to Australia. So they're going in the bank. That's my mission.
Not a bad philosophy there.
Right. So thank you very much. Have a wonderful evening. I hope you have something great in your glass later tonight. And I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Laurie. Nice chatting.
Nice chatting. Have a great night.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Laurie Hoyt-Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, sláinte!